My name is Kathy Coxon, and I'm a member of Al-Anon. You know, I don't remember exactly when, and I don't remember who called me initially to ask me to speak, but I remember it was sometime in late 97, and I thought, man, I don't even know where I'll be in 99, or what'll be going on. That just seems so far away to me. And little did I realize how drastically my life would change in that time span. And it's one of the reasons so firmly today that I share with you to live right now and make the most of right now. Because that's all you really know you have. Something may change tomorrow that may drastically change your life. So to live in the moment is so very important. As Gary told you, this is only the second time that I've shared at this level since my husband has passed away. And I don't know, maybe it's a warning to you. This may be emotional for me. A month ago when I spoke in Chicago, it was very difficult. This has been, it's kind of like a trip down memory lane for me to go through the events of my life. And so it may be a little hard, and I just ask that you bear with me. And I know that it's okay if I become emotional, that you understand and that you're with me. And I have to also tell you that, you know, things have been kind of disorganized for me at times in late, because there have been so many changes in my life. And when Gary called me, he said, well, do you want to make your reservations or what? And I said, no, you make them. And he said, well, you know, you're with the airline, you're familiar with the airline and how it works, so are you sure you don't want to do it? And I said, no, I don't want to mess with it. You just do it. Well, I got the tickets, and I just put them in the safe, and I didn't pay any attention to them. I didn't really look at them. And, you know, I mean, this is not meant to put down South Dakota or anything. It's just that, you know, I live way down in Texas, and as far as I'm concerned, you're way up in the top of the country. And I don't know anything about you, or the area, really. I just know it's a state up here where they do winter. And snow. And all the different cities and where exactly you are, I'm not real sure because I don't pay that much attention. And that is my ignorance. Well, I don't know. For some reason, I kept thinking I was going to Sioux City. And everybody kept asking me where I was going to go. And I said, well, I'm going to Sioux City. Well, last week I did Girls Night Out with my mom and my sister for a week. And I was telling them I was going to Sioux City. And I certainly hope I didn't get snowed in because I had to go through Minneapolis and they had a lot of snow. And that was my main concern. And I got home, and I was looking at the paper, at the weather forecast, and I thought, now, am I going to Sioux City or Sioux Falls? I thought, well, I better get those tickets out and look at them. Well, it was Sioux Falls, and I apologize, but I just, you know, for some reason, I kept feeling like I was going to Sioux City, so Sioux City almost got me, and thank God, Gary made the reservation, so I ended up in the right place. Al-Anon tells me that I should tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. Now, before I do that, I want to make a few things clear. I am not an authority on Al-Anon. All I have is my own story, my own experience, how my life has changed through Al-Anon, and how I work the Al-Anon program in my life today. That's all I have to share with you. Anything else would be opinions, and that would do you nor me any good. I also need to tell you that my husband and I shared everything since the day we were married. We shared the good times and we shared the hard times. And we certainly shared his alcoholism. Now, I'm not here to take his inventory, but I do have his permission to tell you anything about his drinking as it relates to my story. However, I'm not here to sing a He Done Me Wrong song either. I'm here to share with you my part in the family illness known as alcoholism, and mainly to share with you my recovery in that illness. I'm the youngest of four children, and I might tell you right off that I was just a tad spoiled, and I was. My mom thought I had my dad wrapped around my finger, my dad thought I had my mom wrapped around my finger, and my sisters and brother just gave in to me. Now, at a very early age, I decided on a philosophy for myself to live by, and my philosophy was this. I can do anything that I want to do. All I have to do is make up my mind, and I can do it. And I can do it all by myself. I don't need anybody's help. And furthermore, I can do it with a degree of perfection. Now, I learned very quickly, if I was going to live by this philosophy, I couldn't ask questions. Because if you get to asking questions, people will figure out that you're not old enough, smart enough, or wise enough to do whatever it is you're wanting to do. So I had to figure those things out for myself and then do them. Now, about this same time, I came up with my own philosophy for God. Now, my philosophy for God came from a statement I heard my mother make many times. And the statement was this. Anytime anyone would do anything harmful or hurtful to someone, my mother would say, God will take care of them. And that confused me, but you have to remember, I couldn't ask questions, so I had to figure that out for myself. Now, I went to Sunday school and church, and I knew that God loved everybody. So I decided what she must mean is that God is a loving God, but he's a punishing God. And he's up there with a scorecard, and he's keeping score. And if you do good, you get a check mark. And if you do bad, he'll punish you. After all, how many times did I hear my mother say, God gave you a brain, use it? So this had to be how that worked. I was supposed to figure things out, do them, and then God would grade me. Now, that wasn't at all what my mother meant by that statement. My mother would have been horrified had she known about my philosophy for God. But you see, up until recent years, my mother never knew about my philosophy for God. You see, I figured things out, and I didn't bother discussing it with you to see if it was right or wrong. That just became fact to me, and I went on about my business of living. And that's what happened with God and that philosophy. Now, I was one of those children that grew up in a very secure, loving environment. If anyone ever came from the all-American loving home, I surely did. There was a lot of love shown in that home. There was never a doubt in my mind but what I was loved and wanted. And it was an extremely secure environment. However, I came out of that extremely secure environment very insecure. And I knew that it wasn't okay for you to know how insecure I was. Because if you knew how insecure I was, you wouldn't let me do the things I wanted to do. So I had to cover that up, and I learned that very quickly in life. Now, I was one of those kids that was never any age. I vividly remember on my 13th birthday, I was 13 that morning. That afternoon, if you would have asked me how old I would have told you I was going on 14. And that was just the story of my life. I was always going on something else. I had things to do, places to go, people to see. I was in a hurry to grow up. You see, I decided quite early that when I grew up, I wanted a career. And I wanted that career to be that of an airline stewardess. And I just knew they'd probably do away with that profession before I got old enough to be one. So I had to hurry up and grow up so I could get that job. Now, I have to tell you that my philosophy worked for me for many years. Anything I wanted to do, I did. Anything I set out to accomplish, I accomplished it. And I did do it with a degree of perfection. Well, I finally got old enough to apply for that job of an airline stewardess, and they hired me. And that tells you right there how long ago it's been, because they're no longer called airline stewardess. But I've been, I applied for that job, and I got it, and I knew they would hire me because that's what I'd made up my mind I was going to do. And I love that job. I have that same job today, and I still love that job. I'm just one of those very fortunate people who enjoys what they do for a living. Well, I've been flying for quite some time, and I've been dating this guy for about 4 years, and he lived in Miami, and I lived in Dallas. One day I was over at my mom and dad's, and my mother said, "Are you ever going to marry this man?" Well, I was quickly approaching age 28, and I guess she thought she might have an old maid on her hands, and she didn't want that. Well, very shortly after that, he phoned me up one day from over to his sister's. He had a sister that lived in Miami, and he phoned me from her house, and he was on the phone, and she was on the extension to the telephone, and he asked me to marry him. And what could I say but yes? I mean, he was on the phone, his sister was on the phone, my mother was wondering if I was going to marry him, all of his friends had been asking when we were going to get married. So what could I say but yes? Now, I have to tell you, from that moment until the moment I walked down the aisle, I had doubts about that decision. And I kept saying, God, if this is not what I should do, please let me know. Well, there was no crash of thunder, no bolt of lightning, so I decided it must be the thing to do. So I married that man. And very shortly thereafter, found myself in a very unhappy marriage. And 2 years later, that marriage ended in a divorce. And for the first time in my life, I felt that I had failed at something. And I didn't know how to handle that. Up to that time, I'd never failed at anything in my life. And I blamed him for causing me to fail at something that was very important to me. And I left that marriage with a lot of bitterness and a lot of resentment over that sense of failure. Now, I have to tell you, after getting into this program and getting honest with myself, I contributed to the failure of that marriage way before he did. Oh, we both had our part in the marriage failing, but I certainly was the first contributor. Because, you see, I entered into that marriage not really loving that man as you should love someone to marry them. Everyone else thought it was the thing I should do, so I did it. I also have to tell you that God only showed me in about 500 different ways that I shouldn't get into that marriage. But, you see, I was not in tune to listening for guidance from God or looking for guidance from God. Because in my philosophy, God didn't give guidance. God graded. Well, as I say, I left that marriage with a lot of bitterness and a lot of resentment over that sense of failure. Shortly after that divorce, I started dating this man, and he was absolutely the most wonderful, kind, considerate person I have ever known. And right from the very start, we had the most wonderful thing in our relationship, the ability to communicate. There had been no communication in my first marriage, and I hated that. And here was a man that I could talk to about anything and everything, and I loved it. Well, now, back in the winter, before we started dating that spring, Rod's wife had been killed. And shortly after we'd been dating, he was arrested and charged with capital felony murder in connection with her death. And I thought this was the most unfair thing that I'd ever heard of. How could anybody think this man capable of such a thing? This man who had such respect for life and for living, there was just no way, and I thought it so terribly unfair. Now, Rod had told me from the very start that he was a recovering alcoholic, and I knew nothing about alcoholism. I'd heard of AA, and my only thought about that had been, it's a place where people go who are drunk all the time. That's the only thought I'd ever given it. Well, we spent many hours discussing his alcoholism and AA, and I went to some open AA meetings, and if you would have asked me, I would have told you that I had a marvelous understanding of the disease of alcoholism. Truth was, I understood so little. Well, now, Rod and I both worked for the same company, and due to company policy, he was taken off flight status until the outcome of his trial. And I watched him go through a very difficult time that summer. He so missed flying, and he hated being away from it, and that was hard on him. But I saw something in that man that summer I had never seen in another human being. He had the most unshakable faith that I'd ever seen a person have. And he had this wonderful relationship with a God of his understanding. And he talked about him like he was a friend, and I'd just never seen anybody have that type of relationship with God. And I was so amazed by it. And he wasn't bitter or resentful or critical of the people who had placed him in this position. And I was just totally taken by that. Well, now that winter, his trial finally came about, and he was found not guilty, and of course we were thrilled about that, and he was returned to flying status. And it was in July of that year, 1978, that we were married. I want to say right now that that marriage is far, far more than I ever dreamed a marriage could be. For the first time in my life, I love someone unconditionally. And I never knew I had the ability to love that way. Purely through this man's example, purely through what you had taught him, did I want to learn how to love unconditionally. He just loved me and accepted me. He never once tried to change me. And a lot of days I was a real bitch, and he just loved me and let me be. And purely through his example, purely through watching him, did I want to learn how to love unconditionally. Well, we both continued to fly. We flew as many trips together as possible. Life was just a storybook romance. We had more fun. It was in late October of 1979, I put Rod in the hospital with double pneumonia. And they called in an internal medicine specialist, and after they got him all settled in the hospital, I pulled that doctor aside, and I said, "Now, my husband is a recovering alcoholic. Please don't do anything to endanger his sobriety." And that doctor looked down at me, and he said, "Yes, ma'am, your husband has told me he's a recovering alcoholic. And I will assure you that I have a very good working knowledge of the disease of alcoholism, and I would do nothing to endanger his sobriety," and turn right around and prescribe Percodan 4 times a day for 10 days. Now, I know today that doctor understood alcoholism about as much as I did back then, which was none. Well, after 10 days, they released Rod from the hospital, and I took him home, and there were some errands that he needed to get done, and I told him that I would go do those errands. It was winter, and it was cold, and I didn't want him out in the weather. So I went and did those errands, and when I got back that afternoon, he was asleep. And he slept most of that afternoon. And that evening when he got up, he was in the strangest personality, the strangest mood. I had just never seen this personality before. And I thought, oh, no, they've released him from the hospital too soon. He's not doing well. Well, the next morning, he was himself, and I was just grateful he was feeling better. A couple of days later, I was out taking care of some things, and I came in, and he was asleep. And he slept most of that afternoon, and that evening when he got up, once again, he was in that strange mood, that personality that was so puzzling to me. And I thought, oh, no, he's had too many Anacin today. He's just not doing well. Next morning, he was himself again. And I so wanted to ask him about that mood of the night before, that personality that I was so unfamiliar with. But for some reason, I could not ask him. And this was to be the first thing in our relationship that we could not talk about. And I don't know why, I just couldn't talk about it. Very shortly thereafter, I had to face the realization that my husband was drinking, and I did not know what to do. I was scared to death. Very quickly, those conversations we had had back before we married about alcoholism came back to my mind. And I had remembered that he had said if he ever drank again, he would die. And you have to remember, I take you at your word. He said he was drinking, and I expected instant death. And I didn't want him to die. I loved him. I didn't want to lose him. And that scared me. Very quickly, I knew the terms of the exemption for his pilot's license, and I knew if it said if he ever drank again, once again they'd pull his pilot's license and he would be grounded. And I knew how much he loved flying. I'd had to watch him go through a period of being away from flying, and I didn't want to see him go through that, and that scared me. Well, for a day or two, I just sat around in the paralyzing fear, not knowing what to do. Well, now, I'm one of those people that if I want to learn a new sport, if I want to take up a new hobby, I go and buy a book on it. So I got his AA book, and I quickly flipped through it, looking for the chapter entitled, How to Get Him Back to AA. Now, I'm here to tell you the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is very incomplete. You left a chapter out, and it was a chapter I needed. Well, I tossed that book aside, and I went to the bookstore to find me a book. And I looked through all those books, and I found one. And I'm sure it was the title of the book that sold it to me. It was entitled, The Booze Battle. And for some reason, I thought, yeah, it's going to be a battle. And I got that book, and I took it home, and I flipped through it, looking for the chapter entitled How to Get Him Back to AA. And there was no such chapter in that book either, but I did get something else from that book. It said, if he has been drinking or is drinking, do not talk to him. So we played silence is golden at our house, and it was that deadly, self-righteous, holier-than-thou silence that you can't cut with a knife. Now, I have to tell you that after getting into Al-Anon, I went back and reread that book, and it had many good things to say. Well, one thing, it told me to go to Al-Anon, but you see that focused in on me, not him, and I missed it. Well, as I say, I could tell the silent treatment wasn't going to work for us. I was going to have to do something else. And I decided, well, I'll have a talk with him. And I stayed up most of one night thinking about just what exactly I would say to him. And the next morning, I went in the bedroom to deliver God and the little child talk. And the words just stuck in my throat. And I thought, we can't talk about this. And I don't know why, but I just cannot talk about it. And I thought, well, if we can't talk about it, I'll do the next best thing. I'll write him a letter. And I wrote him a rather lengthy letter explaining just what exactly his drinking was going to lead to. And I wasn't brave enough to give it to him. I left it on the nightstand so he would find it first thing the next morning when he woke up. And I got up real early that morning and I left home because I wanted him to have time to read that letter over and think about it. Now, I just knew, as naive as it sounds, I knew when I went back home, he would say, Kathy, you're right. I'm going back to AA. I just knew that would happen. Well, I waited for what I thought was the appropriate amount of time for him to come to this conclusion, and I went back home, and he didn't mention the letter. And I thought, well, maybe he missed it. I don't know how he could have, but maybe he did. And I went rushing into the bedroom, and the letter was gone, so I knew he read it, and he didn't mention the letter all day. And I thought, fine, I'll write you another letter. And I did. And he didn't mention that letter either, and that made me angry. I thought, how dare you? After I've taken all my valuable time writing you, telling you what your drinking's going to lead to, and you don't even acknowledge getting the letter, let alone discuss it with me. Well, I thought, well, I have to do something else. And, you know, one day it just came to me. You know why he drank? He had too much free time. And he didn't know how to plan his time out. And if his time was planned out, then he wouldn't drink. Well, just as things would have it, I was going to have to go to a training class all day. So I made out a long list of things for him to do that next day when I was going to be gone. And that morning before I left, I explained that list of things to him just like any mother would to their child. And I remember when I was driving away from our home that morning, looking in the rearview mirror thinking, there's no way he can drink today. He has too much to do. Now, when I got home that evening, you and I both know nothing on that list got done. But he had time to drink, and that just blew me away. I thought, how did he do it? He had too much to do today. Now, this was our life. I lived in active alcoholism for a period of 4 months. And every day of that 4 months, I had a different plan on how to get him back to AA. And in the evening, when that day's plan would have failed, I would have that brief sense of failure. And then very quickly, my mind would say, you can do it. You can find a way to get him back to AA. And I'd be off and running on another plan, on another way to get him sober. Now, I have to tell you that I never saw my husband take a drink. I have no idea how much he ever drank. What I saw, what I focused in on, was that personality change that happens when the alcoholic takes the first drink. And that's what I looked for. And the slightest personality change, if you would have asked me, I would have told you he was drunk. Now, a couple of months into this, I should have gotten my first clue that there might be something wrong with me. At this particular time, we lived on a lake 5 miles outside of Dallas. And I was based and flew out of the Dallas-Fort Worth airport, and he was based in Los Angeles and flew out of that airport. So he would drive to Dallas, catch an airplane to Los Angeles, and then start his trip. Now, I have to tell you, I did not have to have my husband at home to have a bad day. My worst days, my craziest days, I was home alone. And this was just one of those days. He had left very early that morning to drive to Dallas to catch an airplane out to Los Angeles to start a trip that would end in Montreal, Canada that evening. Now, if I was at home and he was on a trip, he would phone me from his layover. And that evening, when he had not phoned me by what I thought was the appropriate time, I got off into that wonderful world of what if. And I was good at it. And I decided, okay, here's what's happened. He started drinking on the airplane going out to Los Angeles this morning, and by the time he got to Los Angeles to operations, he was drunk, and they fired him, and how many hotels are there in the L.A. area? How am I ever going to find him to get my hands on him to help him? And I stood around with this for a little while and got a little bit crazier, and I decided, well, I'll call the hotel in Montreal where we lay over. I know he's not there, but I'll call just to give him the benefit of the doubt. And I called that hotel, and the hotel operator said, oh, that airline doesn't stay here any longer. And I said, well, do you know where they might stay? And she gave me the name of another hotel and another number, and I called that hotel, and they didn't stay there, but she gave me another name of a hotel and a number. And after calling about 6 hotels, I decided, well, the only thing I ought to do is call crew schedule, and I really hate to do that, but if I'm ever going to find him to help him, I better get on with it. And I called crew schedule that evening, and a friend of ours answered the telephone. And I said, Jim, do you have the number of the hotel where we stay in Montreal? And he gave me a phone number. And I said, Jim, we don't stay at that hotel anymore. Don't you have a current hotel list? And he said, well, no, Kathy. He said, what's Rod's sequence number? I can put it in the computer and maybe it's on there. And I gave it to him and he said, I'll be right back. And I thought, what am I going to do? I know he's going to come back on this phone and he's going to say, Kathy, Rod's not on that trip. And how does that look? His own wife doesn't know where he is. That old pride and ego. Well, for some reason, I stayed on the phone. A few minutes, Jim came back, and he said, Kathy, they had a mechanical when they landed in Toronto, and he'll be landing in Montreal in 2 or 3 minutes. And then he said it to me. He said, Kathy, are you okay? I said, I'm fine, thank you, and slammed down the phone. I thought, how dare you ask me if I'm okay? You ought to be more worried about the captain of that airplane. He's out with your multimillion-dollar airplane. He may be drinking. Asking me if I'm okay. You and I both know I wasn't fine. I was falling apart at the seams. That game of what if was real to me. I just knew that's what had happened. Well, in a few minutes, Rod called me from Montreal, and I didn't bother telling him I'd been looking all over Canada for him. I just let it pass. Now, with Rod and I both flying, whether we were both on trips or whether one of us was home and the other one was on a trip, sometimes this meant trying to control the alcoholic from 2,000-3,000 miles apart at times. I accepted the challenge. I was up to it. I mean, when you've been running the universe all of your life, what's 2,000 or 3,000 miles? Now, we don't have any children, so I didn't mess up the mind of any little children, thank God. But we did have a little dog. And this little dog kind of ran our house. And the home we lived in at the time, there was a long, slender window on each side of the front door. And when you drove into the carport, she would go to one of those two windows. And if the ears were down, the tail was down, and she wasn't barking, that meant he was drinking. And I thought, see there, she doesn't like it any better than I do. Now, I know today that the ears were down, the tail was down, and there was no barking because of me, not him. I'm sure she sensed that the drinking wasn't good, but more than that, she knew if he had been drinking and I came home, I wasn't going to want to play with her. And I was going to make her go lay in a corner and leave me alone so that I could come up with another plan, another way to get him back to AA. You know, I've heard it said that alcoholism is a lonely disease. And I think that's so true, be it the alcoholic or the family. And the family has that awful loneliness of nobody else has to live like this. Nobody else has to hide in your home. That awful loneliness of 3 a.m. when I would be awake and everybody else would be asleep. And there are no answers at 3 a.m. It's a mountain that you can't get over. It's an insolvable problem, and there are no solutions. And it's the darkest, loneliest time in the world. And that's the loneliness that the family knows. Now, the fear was the worst thing for me. It was my constant companion. You know, when I went through stewardess school, they drummed in our heads, when you get on that airplane, passengers have problems, you don't. So when I went to work, I could put all of this out of my mind, and I could get into those passengers, and I could get into their problems. And the instant I would step off that airplane into the limo to go to the hotel in my layover, it would all come rushing back in on me. And I would get to that hotel and get my room key and rush upstairs to phone home to see if the man I loved answered the telephone or to see if that stranger answered the phone. And when that stranger answered the phone, I could hang up and I could worry, how am I going to stop him? How am I going to get him back to AA? How am I going to keep him from killing himself or somebody else? And slowly drive myself crazy. Now, the fear was made up of these things for me. The F was my frustration, trying to stop my husband from drinking, trying to get my husband back to AA. When you feel your heart breaking, the pain is unbearable. When you have to stand by and watch the man you love more than life itself slowly killing himself, and you can't stop him. But worst of all, you can't help him. It's a frustrating experience. The E was my ego. I can do it. I can find a way to get him back to AA. I have to find a way. To talk to anybody would be to betray my husband, and I don't want to betray him. I just want to help him. The A was my anger. You know, from the very first I realized he was drinking, I thought, why? During all those discussions we had about alcoholism, why didn't he tell me what I should do if he ever went back to drinking? I know today he never told me because he never planned on going back to drinking. And the R was my resentment. I resented him because I felt he was destroying himself and destroying our life together, and I resented that. And then I resented God because I felt that God was using my husband to punish me for I knew not what, and I resented that. And I thought, God, I don't deserve this. Never thinking, neither did my husband deserve to go back through the hell of drinking. Well, after 4 months, I came in from a trip, and Rod was sitting on the sofa. Now, it never entered my mind that I had been about 1,000 miles away when this decision had been reached, but I came in, and he was sitting on the sofa, and he said, Kathy, I need to talk to you. And I was shocked because we had not talked in 4 months. And I sat down on the sofa, and he said, Kathy, I need to do something about my drinking, and the only thing I know to do is to go back to AA. And here again, I was shocked. He said he had been drinking. You see, this was an understood thing at our house. We never talked about it. We each just played our own sick little game. Him on how he was going to drink and get away with it, and me on how I was going to stop the drinking and getting back to AA. But we never discussed it. We never verbalized it at all. It was kind of like there's a pink elephant that lives in our living room, and we both know it's there, and we'll just tiptoe around it, and maybe it'll go away. And that was our treatment for alcoholism. And he said he was going back to AA, and I thought, great, that's all I want. I knew you folks worked. And I thought, life will be just like it was before, and that's all I want. And the next night, he did go back to AA. And he'd been in AA a couple of months when the company became aware of the fact that he had been drinking, and the federal government became aware of the fact that he had been drinking. And this meant that they would pull his pilot's license, and he would be grounded for a period of time. And he would have to go through an exemption program to get his license back. And he would be able to get his license back, but it would take a period of probably 6 months to a year. And I really hated to see him go through that, but my main thought was, as long as the drinking stops, I'll go through anything. Please note, I said I would go through anything. Whether or not he was willing to just never entered my mind. I never even gave that a thought. It was only what I was willing to go through. Now, the first thing that would happen in this exemption process is that we would have to see a federally approved psychiatrist. And the company phoned up just such a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist says, is he married? And they said, yes. And he said, good, I'd like to see her too. Now, I thought that was a little strange, but I thought, I don't mind, I'll go. And the next day, we went up to Baltimore, Maryland to see Dr. Wiseman. And we went in Dr. Wiseman's office, and he said, I'd like to see Kathy by herself for a few minutes. And I found that real strange. I thought, talk to him, man. I've been handling it all. He's the one who's been drinking. Well, I went in Dr. Wiseman's office, and he said, Kathy, during the drinking, what did you resent most? And I said, well, I resented the fact that during the drinking we couldn't communicate. That was my most prized thing about our relationship, and during the drinking we could not communicate. And he shook his head, and he said, you need to go to Al-Anon. And I said, okay. The next day, the company phoned up, and they said, Dr. Wiseman has recommended that Rod go to a treatment center that has a family program so Kathy can go. Now, I found that real strange. But in my way of figuring things out, I decided they just want me to go so I can learn everything I can about this disease so I can help him. And the next day, I took him up to a place in Denton, Texas called Westgate. And I saw the family counselor, and she said, you go to Al-Anon? And I said, no. And she said, you need to go. I said, fine. When can I see my husband again? She said, on Wednesday night, we have family night. On Friday night, there's an open AA meeting. And on Sunday night, you can visit. I said, 3 times a week, that's all? She said, that's all. You see, I buy a little hotel up there by that treatment center, and I was going to move in for the 28 days, so I'd go to the hospital every day and help him. Well, now, I went to those Wednesday night meetings, and I went in there, and I listened to those family members, and I thought, my God, these people are sick. I don't know anything about this thing called Al-Anon, but I certainly hope it can help them, because they need help real bad. I know today that I went in there comparing rather than trying to identify. And when I had not done the exact same thing that those people had done, there was nothing wrong with me. And I know today that any time I get into the business of comparing, once again, I am unique and different. I have been unique and different all of my life. I have to try to identify with you. Rarely are our actions the same. But the reasons behind those actions, the sheer survival instinct of it, are almost always the same. I have to try to identify with you. Well, the 28 days was finally up, and I saw the family counselor once again. She said, you're going to Al-Anon? And I said, no, but I'll go. And the next night, June the 2nd, 1980, I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. And I only planned to go to that one meeting. You see, I am a very gifted person. You do not have to explain things to me. I can figure them out. And one night, it just came to me what you did in those Al-Anon meetings. Now, I had not read any Al-Anon literature. I was given some by the hospital, but I didn't read it. I had not talked to anybody about Al-Anon. But all of a sudden, I knew exactly what happened in those meetings. And I knew that all you did was sit around and bitch and complain about the alcoholics. And I didn't want any part of it. But I would go to one meeting so that the very next person who said to me, you need to go to Al-Anon, I could tell him I had been and it was not for me. And don't ask me why I thought I needed to go to a meeting to tell you that. I guess I thought you might have some way of knowing whether or not I had really been, and I didn't want to get caught in a lie. So I would go to that meeting. Now, two things happened at that meeting. For one, they made me angry, and for another, they gave me a whole new purpose for going to Al-Anon and got me back to a lot of meetings for a long time. Now, the thing they said that made me angry, they said, you let the AAs help your husband, and we'll help you. And I said, okay. And I thought, you are crazy. First of all, you can't help me because there's nothing wrong with me. Second of all, I am going to help my husband. That's how it works at my house, and I'll help you when I get time because obviously you have it wrong. Now, the thing they said that changed my whole purpose and got me back to a lot of meetings, they said, we work the same 12 steps that AA works. And it was like a light bulb turned on in my head. I quickly read those steps over, and I knew that none of them applied to me. But I knew that all of them applied to him. And I would go to as many meetings as I could possibly get to. I would learn everything I could about those steps so I could help him. And that became my purpose for going to Al-Anon. And I went a lot. Now, about this time, my husband made a big mistake. He told me, and he told the members of the group, he was having trouble with step 3. And I thought, see there, I knew I could help him. Now, I am a born researcher. I got every book, I got every pamphlet, and if it had a 3 in it, I read it. And furthermore, I read it to him. Now, I selected to do this just before going to sleep at night. I don't know why. I guess I thought, if he thinks about it and he falls asleep, one morning he'll wake up and he'll say, Kathy, I got step 3. I just thought it would work that way. Well, after doing this for quite some time, one night I was in the midst of reading my latest pearl of wisdom to him on step 3, and he stopped me in mid-sentence. And he said, Kathy, if you read one more thing to me on step 3, I am going to throw that book at you. Well, I was furious. I thought, how ungrateful can you be? After I've spent all my time reading and researching, trying to help you, and you don't even appreciate it. Well, I went over, I went to sleep, turned over, went to sleep. I was angry. Next morning, I got up, and I was still mad. And I went out in the yard, and I was working in those rose bushes, and I told him that he would have to suffer. He would have to work this program all by himself. He would not have the value of my help any longer. Now, just to show you how sick I was, before I could get back in that house, I had another plan going on how to help him with his step three. You see, my husband had admitted his obsession. His obsession was alcohol. He was back in AA. He was going to meetings. He was working the steps. I had not admitted nor dealt with my own obsession, which was my husband. During the drinking, I was obsessed with him and the drinking. When the drinking stopped, I was obsessed with him and his AA program. He needs to go to this meeting, not that meeting. He needs to work on this step, not that one. He needs to talk to this man, not that man. Just totally, totally obsessed with my husband. My obsession is and always has been other people and other things. I have always looked at you. I have never looked at me. I have always lived under the illusion all of my life that if I can get everybody in my life lined up all at the same time doing what I need them to do, I'll be okay. Never realizing that's not reality, that's not going to work, and it's not going to help me. But that's the illusion I lived under. Now, about this time, I got a sponsor. As I say, I went to a lot of meetings, and she was at every meeting I went to, and she was always laughing and having a good time, and I thought, I want what she has. And I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said yes, and the only thing that changed, she still was at every meeting I went to, but she would just kind of stand off in a corner and watch me and shake her head a lot. And today, I know that she knew what I was doing, and she just let me do it. And thank God she did, because had she said to me, Kathy, you are so obsessed with Rod and his program, I would have said, oh, no, I'm not. Because, you see, what I say or do and say to you, and then what I think and do, have not always been the same. I will tell you what I think you want to hear, and I will do, and I will think what I want to, and that would have been the case. Now, as I say, I went to a lot of meetings, and I'll be the first to tell you, I went for all the wrong reasons. And at this particular time, I was flying turnarounds, and that's where you go out, fly out of your home base and back into your home base at the same day, the same 24-hour period. So I was flying trips that signed in at 6 a.m., and I would have to get up at 3 a.m. to get ready to drive to Dallas to make that trip. And I would land back in Dallas around 5:30 in the evening, rush home, have dinner, go to a meeting, have coffee after the meeting, get in bed about 11:30 or midnight, and get up the next day and do it again. And many days I would do that 3 or 4 days in a row before I would have days off. But you see, I had to be at that meeting because I just knew one night you would give away that well-guarded secret of how you keep him here, and I didn't want to miss it. Or you would say something about a step that I know he would need to know, and I didn't want to miss it. So I had to be there. Now, I did this for 1 year and 4 months. And Rod and I went to a conference over on the East Coast, and I heard an alumni at that conference share her story. And she talked about how I felt inside. And I cried. For the first time, I could hear. People in my group may have said the exact same thing that she said, but I couldn't hear them. But for some reason, she got through to me. And I left that conference with a firm resolve to go home and start looking at Kathy. And I was shocked. You know, everything I've ever read about steps 1 and 2 says you have to become convinced. And when I got to you, I was not convinced of anything. My life was not unmanageable, and I wasn't powerless over anything. And I had to go to a whole lot of meetings and get a lot sicker through no fault of Al-Anon's before I could become convinced of steps 1 and 2. You know, when I got to step 3, I'm sure you can well imagine with my philosophy for God, I had a difficult time with the God part of this program. You know, Roger said it this morning, it's far easier probably to come here with no belief and learn a belief rather than to have to come here and unlearn a belief and learn a new belief. And in my case, that was true. I would go to meetings, and it would be on step 3, and they would say, just turn it over to God. Just do God's will. And I would think, yeah, I'd like to do that. But how do you do it? Just tell me how. Finally, someone said to me, Kathy, all you have to do in step 3 is make a decision. If and when you ever find a God of your understanding, you can turn your will and your life over to him. Just make a decision and start the journey. And I could do that. You know, when I did that step 4, you know, I was absolutely shocked. I came into Al-Anon polishing my halo, and step 4 took my halo away. For the first time in my life, I had to take a look at me, and I had never done that. You know, to this day, it just blows me away that never in my life, prior to that time, had I ever considered that I might be the problem. You were the problem. If you wouldn't do, I wouldn't have to do, or if you would have done, I wouldn't have to have done. And I discovered a lot about myself in that step four. A lot of things I was going to have to change, a lot of things to do different. And I took my first step five with my sponsor. You know, I was so blessed in this program because I don't think there's a person in the world, whether or not alcohol has ever touched their lives, that doesn't suffer from that thing of, if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. And step five, if honestly taken, gets rid of that for us. I took that first step five with that sponsor, and I told her what I thought to be the worst things in the world that a person had ever done, thought, or said. I shared things with her about myself that wasn't attractive, and she shared back with me. And when it was over, she hugged me and told me that she loved me. And this is a person who knew all about me, and she hugged me and told me that she loved me. And I knew a new freedom that I had never known before. I want to spend a few minutes on step six and seven because these have been such unbelievable steps in my growth here. You know, I would have loved to, with all the humility in the world, said, God, these are my defects of character, these are my shortcomings, remove them, and he would have. And if that worked that way for you, I think that's wonderful. It just didn't work that way for me. I'm a little hard-headed, and I hang on to things, and it took a lot more. As long as I have been willing to look at character defects, very slowly they've come to mind. And thank God I didn't see them all at once, because if I would have seen them all at once, I would have said, no way, can anybody change that much? Forget it. But very slowly, as long as I have been willing, they have come to mind. But they've been hard for me to see because they are my normal behavior. You know, I did not catch one character defect from living with an alcoholic. Active alcoholism may have magnified some of those character defects, but I already had them when I got him. I had those character defects. They're mine. I have to rid myself of them. When I have recognized those character defects, and maybe ask God to remove them. And he has, but I have had to change the behavior that went along with those character defects in order to not have them. I have to participate in my own recovery here. Now, one of these character defects was this thing of wanting you to think that I'm perfect. I know I'm not, and that's okay. What's important is you think that I'm perfect, and I will go to any length for you to think that. The only problem with that is you can't walk into a meeting and say, I don't understand. I hurt. I'm confused. People won't think you're perfect. So I had to rid myself of that character defect before I could really get on the road to recovery. Now, this next character defect you're probably going to find a little hard to believe. I could not see that I was a controller. My mother is a controller. You ask my father a question, my mother answers. That's a controller. What I do is give guidance, and heaven only knows I am qualified to give guidance. I'm God's right-hand man. I know best. Now, the situation that brought this to mind was an incident that happened a lot at our house. We'd be driving along in a car, and one day it dawned on me. My husband drives around with a little traffic director in the car. We'll be driving along, and everybody up ahead is stopping, and we're not. And I'll say, gee, something must have happened up ahead. Everyone is stopping. There's always a policeman that sits in this little town. I saw 10 policemen on this stretch of highway just yesterday. Everything except, slow down, I'm uncomfortable at the speed at which we're traveling. Now, that's what my mother would do. I could see that's controlling. And I have to say, no, you do the worst kind of controlling, that underhanded manipulating, so I can move you I want you to go and you don't know it controlling. One night I went to a meeting with Rod, and I was sitting several rows back, and this couple came in late, and they sat down in the front row, and I got to watching them. And every few minutes, the lady would elbow her husband. And I continued to watch this, and every few minutes, she'd elbow him. And it dawned on me, every time Rod said something that she wanted to make sure he heard, she elbowed him. And I thought, there you are, Kathy. And I could see how awful that was in that woman. But you see, I love controlling. I'm uncomfortable when I'm not in control. One of the reasons it's so hard for me to share with you and to become emotional is that I'm not in total control of my emotions or myself, and that's uncomfortable for me. It's a horrible character defect. And I have to work on it constantly. Because controlling other people only damages relationships, be it a husband, be it a friend. It's not an attractive characteristic. And I have to work on that. I'm one of those people that has lived life very rigid. And that's by my own design. My parents didn't insist on me living that way. They're not that way. But I am a very organized, in order, don't get it out of order, you'll mess it up if it's out of order, personality. And that is difficult. And it's more difficult when you try to impose that on other people. And I'm sure, as you can well imagine, I often had tried to impose that on those most nearest and dearest to me, namely him. And he didn't appreciate it. You know, basically I have a philosophy that we each have a box. And that box is divided into a lot of little cubicles, and you run around in and out of those little cubicles, and you stay in your box, and life goes along great. The only problem, if you have an alcoholic like I had an alcoholic, he gets out of the box, and I don't understand that. I just want to slap him back in and say, stay in the box, and life will be okay. Don't get out of the box. And he gets out of the box. You know, basically, I'm a rule abider. If it says do not, I don't. You know that tag on your pillow that says, do not remove? That tag's on my pillow. If you have an alcoholic like I had an alcoholic, if it says do not, he does. And I don't understand that. You know, we travel quite a bit, and a lot of times when we would get someplace, we would rent a car, and invariably, first thing off, he would say, let's take a shortcut. Oh, why? This is a wonderful road. It gets us right where we want to go. Let's take a shortcut. And we would always get lost. Thank God he had a wonderful sense of direction and we always got found, but first we had to get lost. I have seen more bad sections and more towns than I care to tell you about because we always got lost. And invariably on these shortcuts, we would always come across a road that said, do not enter. And you would go, oh, let's go on this road. I would go, we can't. Why not? Well, it says, do not enter. Oh, Kathy, that's not for us. And we'd go off and go down the road, and he's having a good time, and I'm dying. I know we're going to get caught. You know, shortly before he retired, we flew a London trip, and we were on a layover in London, and we're out walking around, and he said, let's take a shortcut back to the hotel. Now we're walking. Well, we got lost, couldn't figure out how to get back in the terminal building, and he broke the alcoholic rule. He stopped and asked directions. And he asked directions of a car park attendant. And this attendant said, do you see that door over there? You go in that door, go up the stairs, go down the hall, turn right, turn back left, and you're in the terminal. We start to walk off, and the guy says, don't tell anybody I told you that. You have to have a badge to do that. Well, we've been out walking, and we don't have our security badges with us. And he says, come on, Kathy, let's go. And I said, well, we can't do that. We don't have our badges with us. He said, Kathy, that's the way back. We got to get back in the hotel, so that's where we're going to go. So we go in the door, down the hall, upstairs, down the hall, turn right, and there is a badge checker. Well, my heart stopped. I know we're going to jail, we're going before the Queen, God knows what. We will not be there to fly our trip the next morning. We're going to be in a lot of trouble. Well, the alcoholic lock kicked in. Just as we approach the badge checker, somebody comes up and asks her a question, and we slip right by her and into the terminal. You know, and he's laughing, and I'm dying. Now, I tell you all this for this reason. You've helped me to learn here that when he insists on doing the do-nots of life, I just have to let him do them. And I have to let him face the consequence of that, good or bad. But he's going to do that, and I cannot stop it. I cannot control it, and I have to let him do those things. In October of 1995, I came in from a London trip, and I was starting my drive home, and Rod was retired at this time, and he called me on my car phone, and he said, Kathy, I need to tell you something. And by the tone of his voice, I could tell it was something I didn't want to hear. And he said, I drank yesterday. And all I could say was, we'll talk about it when I get home. And I hung up the phone, and I would love to tell you that all this time in Al-Anon kicked right in, and I knew exactly what to do. And what I have to tell you is that is not what happened. First of all, I felt physically ill, and I wanted to throw up. But since I was in the middle of downtown Dallas in afternoon traffic, that was not going to be an option. And for the next few minutes, my emotions ran the gamut from one extreme to the other. And then I thought, how could this happen? How could you do this? How could you do this to me? The next thought that entered my mind I knew I was not alone and that I would be okay. Because the next thought that entered my mind was a page from the One Day at a Time book. And on that page, in essence, it says, should the alcoholic drink again, it is not you who is hurt, it is the alcoholic who is hurt. And I knew that it had to be the God of my understanding who gave me that thought. Because believe me, well, the One Day at a Time book and Al-Anon was the furthest thought from my mind. For the next 2 hours, because we lived 2.5 hours from the airport, I talked to God a lot, and I prayed. And when I got home, we talked for a long time. And I was able to be compassionate, and I was able to be a listener. And I was able to let him make decisions about his sobriety or lack of. His decision was to stay in AA and work harder at the program. Some of the decisions that went along with that, I didn't think was right or what I thought should happen, but I allowed him to have those decisions. You see, my pattern would be to tell you how you were going to handle this and how and what you were going to do. And because of what you had taught me, I was able to be a listener, and I was able to allow him the dignity and the responsibility of those decisions. Al-Anon told me not to create a crisis and not to prevent a crisis, and I didn't. Al-Anon told me that if I would take certain steps, I would be okay no matter what the alcoholic did, and I was. For the next period of time to now, I was to enter, very shortly after that, the most difficult time of my life. In May of 1996, my dad was diagnosed with colon cancer. And at the time it was diagnosed, it had already gone through the colon wall to the liver. So it was pretty far advanced. Now, I am from a very close family, and I absolutely adore my whole family. And my daddy's my hero, and I'm a daddy's girl. And I was absolutely devastated. And I thought, he'll do treatment. They said it's treatable, we'll do treatment. And I let my dad know that. Even though this is such a difficult time, it was probably one of the most growing times I've had. I learned a lot about myself. I came to a new level of acceptance that I had never been at before. I accepted the fact that my dad had a disease which, left untreated, was terminal, but they said it was treatable if he was willing to do treatment. My husband suffered from a disease, left untreated, would be terminal. But there was treatment, if he was willing to do treatment. Thank God my dad and my husband both selected treatment for their individual diseases. After a year and a half of many types of chemotherapy, my dad passed away in November of 97. You know, one of the realizations I came to during this time, and it was a hard thing to face up to, all of my life, I would have told you that I made decisions for people and tried to guide them in certain directions because I loved them. And I wanted what was best for them. I know today that I do that because I love them, but I do that more based on what is most comfortable for me. Never once when I wanted my dad to do chemo did I ever think about whether or not he could stand to be sick one more time. Never once did I think, is life tenable without alcohol for my husband? I just wanted him sober because that's what was comfortable for me. It was comfortable for me with my dad alive, not dead. I have to allow people I love decisions of their own making because they have to live in those. I don't. I may have to watch those decisions, but I'm not the one who has to live in their skin. It's their decision. And it's a dignity that I have to allow them to make those decisions.
As I say, I was fortunate because they both chose treatment, but after a year and a half, I lost my dad. And I thought, how do you get through that? I just was always so much in being with my dad and calling my dad just to chat or just to ask him a question. And he always had time for me. He always had time to explain it. And I didn't want to not have that. And it was the love and support of people in this program that helped me through that time. 4.5 months after I lost my dad, I had fixed breakfast one morning, and we were getting ready to go play golf, and Rod started having dizzy spells, and he said, I'm so dizzy, and I said, well, maybe I ought to go call 911, or go to the emergency room. He said, no, I'll be fine, just give me a few minutes. And every few minutes he'd have these dizzy spells, and you know how you guys are, you don't want to go to the doctor. Well, finally convinced him to go to the emergency room, and he was having ventricular heartbeats, and they couldn't get them stopped, so they did an emergency arteriogram, and they found that he had 3 major blocked arteries, and they had to do an emergency bypass because they were afraid his heart was going to go into fibrillation. And he came to the surgery fine and had a couple of days of real crazy off-the-wall disorientation after the surgery, and the 3rd day he was himself again, and he was doing great. I even took the dogs up to see him that day. He was just doing so good, and he was himself again, and I was supposed to go fly a trip to Paris the next day because they said he was doing fine. At 11:30 that night, they called me and they told me he was going back to surgery, that somehow the chest closure had opened and he'd have to go back to surgery. And this was just 3 days after the initial surgery. And he came out of that surgery and they couldn't get him off the ventilator and he remained sedated. Little did I know that Monday would have been the last day that I would ever talk to him. He lived for a week and a half. But he was totally sedated the whole time because of the ventilator, and he died. I thought, how do you get through this? In 5 months, I had lost the 2 most important men in my life. And I thought, I don't know how you go on. And it was the people in this program who surrounded me and who have kept me going, who have carried me on. And if you have noticed, my 2 buddies who are with me this weekend, well, they're here because they're my support. They didn't think, since I didn't know where I was going, that I could make it here. So they came with me, just to support me, just to say, it's okay, we're here for you. And that's the kind of love and support I have been shown here. They picked me up and carried me on when I didn't know how I was going to do it or what to do. They've been there for me. And that's the love of this program. That's what it's about. 2 years prior to Rod's death, he had become very active in going into the prisons and taking meetings into the prisons. In both of those years, he was given a Volunteer of the Year award in the state of Texas in the prison system because he was always willing to go and share with those people. One day after the first surgery, a card came in the mail, and it was from the prisoners. And, you know, they can't just run out to Hallmark and buy a card. They had to make their card, and they each wrote him a little note. And in with that card, there was a note with my name on it. And that note said, Mrs. Costin, you will never know how much your husband means to us and how important he is to us and how much we're praying for him. A couple of days later, I went into the ICU unit, and there was a card about 3 foot tall. And they had drawn a card on a piece of poster board and had the counselor bring it up to the hospital. And they'd each written him a note. You know, I think at some time in all of our lives, we think, man, why am I here? make a contribution to my fellow man? Why am I here? What can I do? Rod Costin made a contribution. He made a difference to some people through this program. Did he do it perfect? No. But who of us does? I don't know why he had trouble staying here, and that's unimportant today. Never once did I ever see a time when somebody called at the most inconvenient of hours who needed help that he wasn't willing to go, that he wasn't willing to reach out to the new person and take him to a meeting or talk with him. I'll be forever grateful to that man because he introduced me to a thing called Al-Anon, which showed me how to do life, because I didn't have a clue how to do life until you taught me how. And that's because of him that I got here. I've learned that grief is a very individual thing, that everybody has to do it however they can do it. All you have to do is keep going, and you get through it. Some days it's one day at a time. Some days it's 1 hour at a time. And then there are days that it is 1 minute at a time. But that's okay. I keep doing the things you tell me to do. I stick close to you, and I know that I'll be okay. There is no way that I can ever give back to Al-Anon and AA what I have been so freely given. I've been given a whole new way of life. You've helped me to find a God of my understanding. And I know as long as I stay close to you, as long as I take the actions you ask me to take, there is nothing that the God of my understanding will allow me to go through alone. I also know that just because I stay close to you, just because I take the actions you ask me to take, does not mean that life is now going to be perfect, because it's not. Life comes with problems, situations, and crises. That's reality. All of us, to one degree or another, are going to have difficulties. But what I have today is a set of tools to work through those difficulties. And a God of my understanding who will walk with me through my darkest, deepest valley and rejoice with me on my highest mountaintop. And for someone who thought she had to do it alone, she had to figure it out and do it by herself, that's not bad. I was only going to go to that one Al-Anon meeting. This summer will be 19 years ago, and God only knows how many thousands of Al-Anon meetings ago. I was going to go to that one meeting so that I could tell you that Al-Anon was not for me. I'm here today to tell you that Al-Anon is for me. I love this program. I love the way I feel inside today because I keep suiting up, showing up, and doing the actions that you tell me to do. I want to thank you once again for asking me here this weekend. And I want to close with a little prayer that's given me a lot of strength from time to time. May God bless you with a clear dawning, a cool morning, a warm noonday, a gentle twilight, a starlit night. And if clouds should cross your sky, may God grant you the faith to look for the silver lining. Thank you.